I think people patronize children at their peril, and I think kids almost always have a better idea of what's going on, whether it's what's true or false, you know, more than adults tend to believe, you know.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, chatting with Jamie Harrison about her newest novel, The Center of Everything, which follows Polly, a woman coming to terms with memory, family, and loss in and around Livingston, Montana in the early aughts, and as a child growing up in the late 60s on Long Island Sound. Jamie has lived in Montana with her family for more than 30 years. She's the author of 6 novels. Jamie, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you for having me.
To begin, I was hoping you might be willing to read a passage from The Center of Everything.
Sure. I think I will read the opening pages and page and a half or so. When Polly was a child and thought like a child, the world was a fluid place. People came and went and never looked the same from month to month or year to year. They shifted bodies and voices. A family friend shaved a beard. A great aunt shriveled into illness. A doctor grew taller. And it would take time to find them, to recognize them. Polly studied faces. She wondered. She undid the disguise. But sometimes people she loved disappeared entirely, curling off like smoke. Her father, Merle, told her that the mind was like a forest, and the trees inside were her people, each leaf or needle a memory. Her mother, Jane, said that memories were the way a person tried to turn a life into a story. And Papa, Polly's great-grandfather, said that there was a story about everything. He would tell them something long and strange to explain the existence of tigers or caves or trees, but then he'd say, well, the Greeks said the same thing, or the Finns, the Athabascans, the Etruscans, the Utes. Days were an Aztec snake swallowing its tail. Water came from a Celtic goddess's eyes. Thunder was a deadly fart from a Bantu in the sky. There was nothing new under the sun, but nothing truly repeated. Papa would row down a stretch of the sound and back at high tide, proving his point, slipping home before it was too late to recognize home. But the water and light and noises of the world they'd left were different than the ones they returned to, except for his humming, the splash of his oars, the fact of his presence. Lately, Polly thought her mind was a river, constantly scouring and pooling, constantly disappearing, filling with details that glinted and vanished. Even as an adult, every small thing meant a little too much to her. But these days, she couldn't go on like that, because though the world had become as strange as it was when she was a child, she could no longer indulge it. She needed to buckle down, accept some objective reality.
Jamie, early on in the novel, Polly, the book's protagonist, is described as looking too deeply into things. Further on in the novel, page 111 actually, you write, this bizarre tendency to look at something until it practically melted. What are you looking too deeply into these days?
What am I? Well, probably a book release right now. With Polly, I was trying to capture what it's like to have a brain injury of some sort, to lose your control either through an injury or through depression or through some other disturbance and not be able to turn your mind off.
And I should say, for the benefit of listeners, that Polly, the protagonist, she's been in a bicycle accident and she does have memory issues. And memory is sort of the hinge around this entire book. Everything is kind of this investigation into memory. How much of Polly is Jamie Harrison? Or how much of Jamie Harrison is Polly?
A lot of Polly's past is my past. I lived in New York in my 20s, too, as Polly did. I worked at a place called Dean and DeLuca, like Polly does. I did live on Long Island when I was a child. But beyond that, there's really not much. Polly runs a restaurant. She's got children who are different ages. She has different thoughts. You can't really, though, pull apart. Obviously, you're the writer. And I kind of believe in all the characters I write. So little bits of you come out in everything. It's hard to pull apart.
You also write that every story was an echo, an inherited memory. What is your book echoing? What memories is it made of? How did it start? How did it change? Where did this book come from?
This book began actually as a story about two children on Long Island. It was sort of a magical story. It was written up as a treatment for the movies. And I put it away after it didn't sell and went back to it another time, maybe as a novel, but just for a few weeks, just spent a few weeks on it. And I picked it up again much, much later. I did live on Long Island when I was a kid. I was 6, 7, and 8. And I did not grow up the way Polly did particularly, but I did grow up with parents who were teachers. And I grew up in a sort of the same sort of environment, a lot of professors, a lot of odd houses with odd objects. I was born in 1960, just to bust myself on this, I'm ancient. So the Vietnam War was on TV every night. And Life magazine and magazines like that had truly bloody scenes in them. Now we don't see war footage. We don't see our soldiers dying or anything like that. But back then you really did. And I just didn't have as sheltered of a childhood as a lot of people did in a lot of ways, because it was also the 60s. My parents were young. Everybody was doing whatever everybody did in the 60s. You know, they were in their 20s. And so it was not a hippie childhood, but it was a fairly wide open childhood. And my friends and I consistently would remember now that nobody thought we knew what was going on, but we knew absolutely what was going on. We knew who was having affairs, we knew who was doing this and that. It was completely obvious, even when you're a kid, even when you're happy with your family and secure. It was almost funny, the fact adults didn't have a clue that we had a clue. I think people patronize children at their peril. And I think kids almost always have a better idea of what's going on, whether it's one of their parents' parties, whether it's how their parents are getting along, whether it's what's true or false. You know more than adults tend to believe, you know. I was writing this during the summer, and there was a drowning. And there is most summers, you know, in Livingston, Montana, where I live, somebody is always going lost in the Yellowstone River. And somehow I just sort of decided to use that as a pacing element and to tell the story of a woman who is living through a summer where a helicopter goes overhead looking for the body of her friend in the river, and have her go back in time to her childhood when a similar drowning took place.
Why did you come back to it? What was the impetus to return to it and finish it as a novel?
Part of the reason I started doing it, I was doing it for a screenplay. I was working on one with my father, and we liked the idea. And it was partially based on, even then, what kids remember. It was sort of a ghost story. And I started it essentially after watching a friend of my son's go through the grief of losing her father. She was only 5 or 6. And when we were writing that, this had just happened. And she was over at our house a lot. They were really close. They were in kindergarten. It was hard to watch. And the story was sort of about trying to re-find a father, a lost parent, which is essentially what Center of Everything ends up being about too. And part of the reason I think I picked it up again is my parents died within 6 months of each other. Right when I was sort of thinking of starting this again. And I think it's sort of written out of trying to remember, and also written about wanting to write about somebody a lot like my mother, about family, about how important it is, how you feel like you want to keep them with you just by the act of memory. And so I wanted to write about a character like that, who is really sort of trying to do that, to keep her memory, literally.
The title of the book comes from a line towards its beginning: good mothers were rarities, the center of everything. Can you tell me a little bit about your mother?
My mother was really a lovely, you know, wonderful, smart person. She had many, many good friends. She never worked much. She basically dealt with my father, who was a handful, if anybody knows anything about him. They had a long, pretty good marriage, but she was my best friend and my sister Anna's best friend. We just really adored her. And it's not that we didn't love our father, but so much of our lives, people's asked us about our father. and he was wonderful and I miss him, but I still think of my mother every day. One thing about my mother, we did have an argument very much like the argument that an ongoing argument over the years, affectionate but sort of barbed, about what I remembered and what I didn't remember, either of misbehavior in the 60s or especially about the fact that in my family, we had a tragedy just like Polly's family had. In the book, I describe Polly losing her grandfather and her aunt in an accident. And in fact, that happened in my father's family. And in fact, when I was two or three, I thought I could find them again. I had some strange theory of death that nobody else really understood, that these people had disappeared to another city and become young again. And since we were going to the city, I would find them and I would make everything okay for everyone again. My mother couldn't quite believe that I could remember anything that early, but I remembered so many details of looking for them, she finally accepted it. So that part of it is all pretty autobiographical. There's a scene in the book where Polly and her mother go to a dry cleaner's or a laundry, and Polly thinks she sees her lost grandfather and aunt, and that in fact happened.
This book, because it's about memory, is also about mythology, and it's also about legacy. And as we've talked about, it's undeniably about family. How do you navigate your family mythologies? And I know that you said you've talked about your father a lot, but how do you navigate your father's very public legacy?
Well, the way I used to navigate it was by, I very deliberately chose to write mystery novels when I first decided to write. And I certainly, growing up, did not want to be a writer or think that that was a good way to make a living. My father was primarily a poet and a novelist at first and probably didn't make a living until he was about 40. And he also really truly felt a calling. I mean, he was a poet. It's always what he wanted to do. And I was sort of more practical. I only began writing after I lost my job and I had a small child and I needed to make a living. And I thought I could try. I loved reading mysteries, so I thought I could try it. And writing mysteries was enough of a distance. But, you know, I loved growing up the way I grew up. I grew up surrounded by books. I grew up loving reading. And this is stuff that my father gave me, books and food and just loving life.
So you live in Livingston, Montana. What makes Livingston ripe for fictionalization? Why set your stories there?
I think it's an interesting town. I've actually set four mysteries there too that I wrote 20 years ago. I've lived here for more than 30 years. And I think Livingston has quite a grand variety of people. People come here for strange reasons. There are plenty of people who obviously grew up here, but there's so many refugees from cities, from other situations in life. And if they can make it here, it's sort of like New York, they can make it anywhere, given the wind, given the lack of jobs, given this and that. You really have to want to live here, but there's all sorts of reasons to want to, because it's an absolutely gorgeous place.
The center of everything centers water, largely the Yellowstone River, but also Long Island Sound. Shakespeare's The Tempest makes multiple appearances, and Jane, Polly's mother, as a graduate student, is interested in the origins of flood stories. What's so attractive to you about water?
Maybe we write about what we're afraid of to some degree. I mean, so much in the town where I live revolves around water, and I love going out and kayaking. I love being on the water. I love living by the river. I grew up on Lake Michigan. It's just such a force if you actually grow up near a body of water, like either this river or Lake Michigan, or the Sound for that matter. I grew up in a fishing town and people did drown regularly. And I guess just the power of the thing, the ice in the winter shearing off houses, the weird scariness of going out on the ice to skate or to ice fish or anything like that. It's such an elemental force. And I'm really not sure why I used it this extensively in the book, but once I started to, I went with it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Jamie Harrison, author of The Center of Everything, I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What has the release of this book been like, especially after it had been delayed?
It has gone as well as it possibly could. I think it's really hard. There's so many good writers. There's so many good books. There's so few venues to publicize them or review them now. The hard thing is the pressure of social media, the sort of weird spastic way it makes you feel when you have to try to sell yourself. It's hard to do and you need to do it, but it leaves me frazzled and it's hard to concentrate on other things. And right now I sort of just want to write and I need to try to sound intelligent on shows like this and post things on Instagram and Facebook and all that. And so there's the whole business of getting a book into the air. It's hard to know what's going to stick and what's going to make things something last and something sell.
So far so good though?
So far so good. Yeah. I think so far definitely so good. Otherwise I'm looking deeply into struggling with the plot of actually two mysteries after 20 years. I thought it would be fun and sort of lighthearted to write these again. And in fact, it's so difficult. So I'm having a hard time. I'm working on two plots simultaneously.
Is it difficult because it is always difficult and you've just had the benefit of time to forget how difficult it is? Or is it difficult because of the time spent away from it?
I think it's difficult because I forgot. It's sort of like forgetting childbirth. I just forgot how hard it was. And I think it's difficult too, in that a mystery really has to be structured. It has to pay off. You can't just go floating along trying to be beautiful with a line. You've got to make it work. It's a pretty disciplined form. I mean, I think a mystery can be as good as any novel, but to have it pay off as a mystery, you have to have secrets, you have to have payoffs, and the question of how you pace it is so key. I've never in my life been able to just sit down and write a book beginning to end in a linear way. And so when something occurs to me, I will write it down. I will write a couple of pages. And at the stage I'm in now, I'm unfortunately surrounded by 200 pages, not in the correct order.
You kind of answered a question I had, which is the center of everything is not a linear book either. And my question was going to be, how did you write this book? How did it come together for you? But it sounds like you probably wrote it in pieces, yes?
I wrote the section with the children in 1968 first. I wrote that out sort of almost as a standalone, that whole thing. I wrote as a short story the part of Polly being in her 20s. In New York. And that was originally going to be a little longer. And then my wonderful editor said, everybody's gone to New York. This is boring me. And so I cut it down. I had to sort of write through Polly as an adult and the drowning in one long string. And then basically I pulled everything out and put it in order, interspersed it and put it back together again with help from my editor, incredible help. He cut a lot of stuff out. And one thing that he cut out was a section that was actually set about the great-grandparents, Papa and Dee, and it was set in about 1920 in Los Angeles. And it was about them meeting each other again after a long time. And I really wanted to include that, but I couldn't. I do love my editor. When he told me that it had to come out. I was laughing at some point at what he was saying. He's got a great sense of humor. And he didn't realize I was actually lying on the floor with tears coming out of my eyes about having to cut it. So there you go. Kill Your Darlings, yeah.
Is it something that could exist on its own as a short story, say?
It'll actually exist, I think, as a third novel that's sort of linked to this one and to The Widow Nash.
Who do you talk with about writing and craft? Who is the soul of your writing community?
There are a lot of writers in Livingston, but this year people haven't gotten together. You really don't see people much. I have always talked to my husband. I mean, he's always been the first reader. I do talk to my wonderful agent, Dara Hyde. She's a very good editor on her own. And my own editor, Dan Smetanka, I will talk through things with him. But in terms of talking about books, I have a couple of good friends here, and we will swap books. They're great readers. So I guess I'm not part of a book club or anything, but I will talk with them about it. And I do a lot of book clubs now, Zoom book clubs, and talk to people. I do listen to a fair number of podcasts when I'm trying to kind of clear my head and become a better writer. I'm right now reading George Saunders' really wonderful book, and I'm forgetting the title, about Russian short stories, and just loving it because it's been so long since I've read them, and I read almost all of them in college. It's great getting back to that.
So this is a question I usually reserve for the end of interviews, but because we're on the subject, I might as well just ask you now. What books would you recommend to listeners, or what books would you want listeners to read after having read your book, The Center of Everything?
One book I've always loved, and it's great fun, and I've loved it both as a mystery writer and as a writer of books like this, is Case Histories by Kate Atkinson. I really recommend it. She's won a Booker for her later works, but some of her earlier books are just, there's so much life to them, but so much complexity. I can tell you that the last book I finished that just absolutely blew me away was Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, which is heartbreaking and gorgeous, and I can only aspire to that. Another writer I really enjoy, and obviously I can't write anything like Cloud Atlas, but is David Mitchell. And he wrote a book called Black Swan Green about a teenage boy that I really recommend to people. I was probably really trying to be that realistic about being in a kid's head when I wrote this.
In an interview for Lit Hub with family friend Thomas McGuane, you mentioned that when you grew up, there were a great many of books surrounding you, which is easy to imagine. And one of those books you mention in this interview was The Family of Man. And you mentioned this book in the novel as well. I want to know what your fascination with The Family of Man is. Where does that come from?
It was a show at the Museum of Modern Art, right? And just to describe it briefly, though I haven't looked at it in a couple of years now, each section of the photography show was about really an age of man, or a, you know, childhood or war or a topic of humanity. And those photos just made a huge impression on me. Some of them are really visceral, photos of birth, photos of death. It seemed like it sort of encompassed life entirely, which was, I guess, the point. And it, looking at that really did take me back to what it was like to be 5, 6, 7. It took me back to the way it felt like to see some of those photos, especially some of the violent photos or the truly lovely photos or the things that were completely mysterious to me. There's so many things you don't understand when you're 5 and you look at a book like that, but you remember them because they make an impression on you.
Polly begins the book by making to-do lists, and in fact, like, lists sort of collage their way throughout the book. So I want to talk about lists. What kind of list maker are you? What's the one thing that you can't cross off your to-do list right now?
I love making lists. I have to make lists or I won't get things done. I won't remember, but I will admit that there are always 2 or 3 things that get put on each new list, you know, every 10 days or so when self-disgust rises and you realize you just haven't gotten it done. I don't know. It's been such a strange year of amorphous chores. There's so little structure to the year that lists have lost their satisfaction, and their, you know, the great joy of crossing something out is somehow missing this year.
There's something very tragic about the fact that list making has lost its meaning this year.
Yes, there is. There is.
You live in Livingston. You lived in New York. You lived on the Sound. What was the research like for this novel then? Or did you have to do research for it?
The research sort of got to the point that we don't know how much we really remember about our childhood. I mean, could you tell me offhand what movie you saw when you were 8? Or what was in the paper or something like that. So I did a lot of that. I looked at what happened in 1967 and 1968 and tried to sort out what I was comfortable with writing about, what I, you know, felt would be interesting to write about without making it too history heavy or anything like that. My memories, nobody's memories are really that reliable for that age. And that's one of the central arguments in the book. But I did spend a lot of time too looking at trying to remind myself what it was like to be a child. And for that, I looked at old Life magazines. I looked at books that I had then, illustrations I would have looked at then, just to try to get that child's eye. Not because Polly is me, but because I wanted to try to bring that back to life.
Why place the novel, the contemporary part of the novel, in 2002?
Well, because I wanted to have the earlier part in 1968. I wanted Polly to be about 8, and I wanted her to have the parallel now of having children who are about the same age, or not now, but in 2002. It was simply a question of timing. I wanted her to be protective for her own children, possibly in a way that she didn't feel protected in her own childhood. I wanted her to be thinking of them in that context as she was remembering back, as she sort of begins losing the margin between what is her current life and what was her past.
And you do that very deftly by basically having Polly, she's continually questioning what her children remember or will remember. You know, she's questioning her own actions and the actions of the adults around her, but in relationship to the children. So I thought you did that very well.
Thanks so much. It's always good to know that you get away with anything at all as a writer. So I really appreciate it. One quick thing. Another reason I had it set in 2002 is because I wanted to have the character of Maud, who is a great, great aunt. And because she is tied to an earlier book I wrote called The Widow Nash, she needed to be, it couldn't be much later. She's, I think I have her turning 90, and I knew when she was born. Because she's not quite a character in The Widow Nash, but she's tied to characters there.
What do you feel Ma, and Ma, I should say, M-A-W, what do you feel her role in the book is?
I think we all remember something that really scared us when we were a child. I don't really know why I picked her. She's just the dark thing at the end of the, she's the thing under the bed. She's the thing down the block. There's something always that you have to be terrified of. There's always ghosts in the corner of your mind, you know, especially when you're a kid, however brave you are. You don't know what's possible and what's not possible. I mean, I spent years not being able to stick my leg out over the edge of the bed.
What was the catalyst for finally being able to do so?
Probably being a teenager and alcohol. I don't know. No, I don't know. I just got over it. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here, Jamie.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Look for more information about Jamie at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.